sir. Very few words can pack as much disdain, sarcasm, and import as the word sir. Military folks are used to using that word and hearing that word used for them, depending on your rank. Very often, when you're a SEAL officer at BUDS or just frankly, a junior officer anywhere in the U.S. military, probably the military of the rest of the world as well, you might be used to hearing that word used kind of tongue-in-cheek a lot. Maybe when someone doubts what you're saying or is going to comply with some sort of directive to you or is just plain making fun of you, they might use the word sir. This word that dates back to at least the early 1200s in England and apparently comes from some sort of derivation from vulgar Latin. I have no idea what vulgar Latin is, but it sounds amazing. I'm pretty sure the vulgar part has to do with sort of old and tribal, but I'm hoping that there's lots of four-letter Latin words that we all can learn together in future episodes if we dive into vulgar Latin. Anyway, the word sir comes from sire. Most speakers here are probably English speakers. For those who aren't, I think we have some listeners from Norway, so shout out to the Norwegian listeners of The Warrior Poet. The word sire is used in the English language, primarily in the mother country of England and the rest of the United Kingdom, to denote someone who is of some sort of royal status in what they call the peerage system. The word sir, though, is also used frequently, again, throughout the U.S. military. The reason I bring up the word sir is because there's this notion in leadership generally, and I'd say probably most prevalent in business as well as the military, is this idea that leaders are above those they lead. I would argue, however, that most people who have real leadership experience know that the truth is very different than that. Now, I'm not dismissing the idea that having some respect from those who follow a leader is very necessary and very much a part of what that leadership dynamic looks like. And if we think about it, I like thinking about very simple examples when it comes to business, when it comes to leadership. I like thinking about maybe if we're centuries ago living in a little village and what that cooperation looks like as a foil to lots of modern conceptions of what it means to actually collaborate, which are very often just fantasies in my mind, very childish fantasies that we perpetuate in modern business culture about what it means to lead and what it means to collaborate. So if we think about that very simple and natural environment, if there's a few people and one is leading in the very literal sense down a path, those behind that person are following. But in order to follow, if we think about what that really means, it means trusting that person in front of you. And it means more than that, sacrificing your freedom of movement. You are willingly deciding not to do whatever you want to do, and you're surrendering your will, at least for that purpose and at least that situation, to the person in front of you. So in that sense, there is some sort of dynamic there where the leader is above that person, but that situation is very temporal. And what I more want to talk about in this episode and reject is this idea that a leader is a more evolved version of those they are leading. That's why this episode is called Erectus. As in Homo erectus, Homo sapiens sapiens evolved from earlier versions of sapiens. the manager in the current context, often in business, has done the exact same job that others have done underneath them. And there are countless problems with this. Before getting into all the problems with this conception, let me tell you a little bit about BUDS. In basic underwater demolition SEAL training, officers go through the exact same training as everybody else. This is an exception to most of the military. However, in some regards, it's very similar perhaps to places where a manager has done the exact same job and has gone to the exact same type of school and training as other people. So if you are the chief of orthopedic surgery at a hospital, I come from a medical family, so that kind of metaphor is very familiar to me. That chief of orthopedic surgery has gone through the exact same school, the exact same residency, the exact same career track as the junior orthopedic surgeons. If you are a senior accountant at one of the big four, chances are you've done the exact same path as those underneath you, just like investment banking, just like consulting, just like an engineering manager. In BUDS, whether you're going on the obstacle course, whether you're hitting the surf, which means getting wet, very cold, probably very sandy, which is designed to just make you suffer through it and see who will quit, whether you're running around with boats on your heads, whether you're shooting, the whole deal, everybody is going through it together. And so officers have this odd experience where you are the lowest of the low, just like everybody else going through training, going through those trials and tribulations. But the instructors and your classmates call you sir or Mr. Sridhar, which makes for this comical experience for those officers going through it and probably also the instructors who are almost uniformly enlisted folks. They are training their future leaders, so they want to make sure that they get good quality in the end. So often officers, especially the class leader, will get a little more special treatment, let's say, in the worst sense of that phrase, than other folks, just to ensure that once downrange in a combat situation, there's not an ineffective officer getting people killed.
From the peanut gallery. Into the water, ladies.
No, man. Let me take a look at that map right quick.
Why is everybody all obsessed with the map?
Because we're tired of being your trail donkeys, acting like you some one-man GPS. God damn it! We lost! We fucking super lost, man!
Despite all this, where everyone's going through the same training, that's where the analogy to this erectus model of the leadership ends. There's no delusion in the US military or the SEAL teams that leadership is not a skill in and of itself. Hypothetically, now granted, there's plenty of enlisted folks and maybe even officers and other folks from the military who may disagree with what I'm about to say, and that's fine. But the idea is that officers have gone to the Naval Academy or some other process and training program selection in order to get into that position where they're an officer and they have some capability to lead that is more than just being smart or being good at a job, that there's a real emphasis on leadership and that is their specialty. A lot of times people will ask me when I tell them I was in the SEAL teams, they'll ask, you know, were you a sniper? Were you this? Were you that? What did you do in the SEAL teams? And the real simple answer, I don't say this because it sounds like I'm being a dick, but the answer is I led. My job was to be a leader. That was my sole job. Really, my stock answer is I was an officer and officers don't have those kind of specialties. Granted, we go to all sorts of schools that are specialty schools for SEALs, but our main job is not to do that thing. Our main job, like senior enlisted folks, is to lead on the battlefield and make sure during training that our men are ready for battle. I don't want to overstate the degree to which the military gets this right. Now, there is this notion of an officer and their core duty and their core specialty being leadership. That being said, the role of an officer and your commission historically could be gotten through means and ways that have nothing to do with a particular ability to lead. A lot of times, military commissions were given out historically for reasons of status, or you could even buy a commission in the British military. It may be the case in the US military. I'm not sure if we go back far enough that's the case. And the idea was that you would have the ability to lead and maybe even get some spoils of war as a result and get wealthy off of this war making. And so a commission might be worth a lot. Perhaps a number of people bought commissions also because they thought they would be safer than some of the some folks who didn't have a commission who were following their orders and maybe getting slaughtered on the front lines. I'm not sure. This is just speculation at this point for me. Along with this historically flawed rationale or means of generating an officer corps historically is that the way leaders in the enlisted ranks and even the officer ranks were promoted was purely for optimizing a very, very fundamental and pressing problem that militaries face, which is getting people to move in the right direction at the right time with situational awareness and communications outbound and inbound about what other units are doing. The military is the basis for so much organizational design and leadership models in the private sector that it's simultaneously something that everyone knows, but that everyone forgets, especially now where the military doesn't represent such a huge portion of the population. But we must remember that the military was where masses of people first gathered in ways that they wouldn't normally gather because there were no companies and factories pre-industrial revolution. But when it came time to defend the homeland or go make battle in order to make up for some slight that your king received, or because he just wanted to conquer some more territory and get some more slaves, then you massed together with a bunch of people. And there also were not just masses of people, but very dire consequences, at least for individuals in that military, if not for the entire state or tribe. Thus, with that being the most pressing problem and with limited specialization aside from maybe some things like cavalry or archery, everyone did the same thing. And the point was to organize so that you're strategically, operationally, and tactically aligned. In that world, it makes sense to promote the people who can do the individual jobs the best, but only to a point. There may be people who can do those individual jobs better than anyone else, but they can't motivate others, they can't communicate, and they can't think smartly enough and quickly enough and in a sophisticated enough manner in order to balance what their unit is doing along with all the others around them in a dynamic situation. Still, that model of promoting individual performers into team leaders makes much more sense in that set of circumstances. However, in the modern era, you have incredible specialization of labor and a number of other circumstances that dictate another model. The most basic problem of most businesses is not moving raw numbers of people with raw motivation in raw movements on a physical plane. There are more pressing problems for most businesses these days. Additionally, with that specialization of labor, a leader often will not know how to optimize individuals in terms of skill sets and in terms of the particular functions they are doing. They merely need to get the best out of them. When I was a SEAL, I wasn't often the best at everything. In fact, I was the best only at a few other things besides leadership. But I had a grounding in how all those pieces fit together. And I could ask dumb questions that could help get the best out of individual snipers, breachers, navigators, etc. Part of the problem that goes along with this leader erectus model of the leader is this idea that everyone is a leader. Many companies today will have this mantra about how everyone is a leader. Amazon is like that. I've been at others and seen others, had friends at others where they also have this mantra. And I think they like it because it's empowering and it puts an onus on everyone in the organization to try and affect change, do the right thing. And all that's well and good. But the fact is, everyone is not a leader. Everyone cannot be a leader or should not be a leader. When you have too many leaders in one spot, it causes problems. Additionally, not everyone has the proclivity or desire to be a leader. And different skill sets, different trades will attract people with different levels of desire to do this. Let's think about fashion. How many people in fashion want to be a leader or will be good leaders versus accounting versus a political campaign versus the military versus Wall Street? You get tons of different personalities and value systems in each of those places where the kind of leadership, the natural desire for leadership, and the skill sets amongst the raw material of people in those specialties will be very, very different. So you can't apply a one-size-fits-all template. Additionally, there's this problem where the role of a leader is a combination of so many different roles that need to be filled. And usually, There's a mistaken assumption that leadership is easy and that anyone can do it. This is definitely not the case. And if there's anything that the warrior poet can help hammer home, it is that leadership is not easy and it should not be taken for granted that anyone can do it. One of my favorite classes at the Naval Academy was a class on the U.S. presidency. In that class, one of the themes was how many different roles the president of the United States has. I think the listing was something like 7 or 10. Some of those are official titles, like head of state. Some of them were less formal, but there are so many different distinct things the president is responsible for doing, and they're all encapsulated in one person. One office of government. They are managing things internally. They are also the chief representative to the rest of the world. And they dictate foreign policy. They dictate military policy. They dictate economic policy. So many different things. I'm not saying whether that makes sense for the US political system or not. What I am saying is that there's the same tendency to expect that the most junior leader does so many things as well, and that they should do so many things besides leadership. For instance, they are responsible for reporting on a number of things. They're responsible for hiring people on their team. They're responsible for getting the best and developing those people. A lot of times, those junior leaders are also responsible for doing some things as an individual contributor as well. And when we combine all these things of leader, manager, reporter, subject matter expert, it makes for a very confusing time for that junior leader and for other people, including the people that that leader is leading, to understand what that person is supposed to be actually doing. Perhaps there's room for a different model where everyone is not expected to lead, and where the expectation of progress for people isn't that they will necessarily become a leader or a manager per se. For instance, the military actually has a path called warrant officer, where someone goes into more of a specific specialty and they're not generally expected to lead massive amounts of people. That does differ depending on the circumstance, but the idea is that they have become a specialist. There are roles in technology now, such as principal engineer, where to some extent the private sector has taken this on. But definitely those sorts of roles where someone is an individual contributor for life are very rare indeed. But companies should consider whether they can double down on that individual expertise and get the most out of people who don't want to become leaders or don't have the most potential to do that. Additionally, you should think about what roles you can have in your organization that aren't necessarily direct people leadership, but that can get the job done in the various different roles that you need filled. So if you need someone to enable your team, that could be a scrum master. If you need someone to report on things, it could be a data analyst or someone in some other reporting function. If you need someone to help manage things, could that be a project manager? Does that have to be someone who has direct reports? Probably not always. And there might be certain circumstances. Let's say you have a team of data analysts. Is it necessary that you have a manager in between you and them? Or could you have an array of functions that piecemeal combine into what you would get out of a manager that you had promoted, but maybe with less risk and maybe better results as well in each of those specialized roles that have been conflated into leader manager?
Are we going to abandon this movie? We're supposed to be a unit.
Suck my unit.
I don't go to too many cocktail parties, but if I did, I'm at that point in my career where some douchey guy I end up with in the corner of the room might ask me, how big is your team? It's like comparing dick sizes. People love to ask each other, how big is your team? This is a flawed notion. The size of your team doesn't matter. Not everyone in your organization needs to be a leader, needs to get bragging rights, and should look at their career path as deficient if they're not leading. You as a leader, your job is to get the best out of people. And sometimes the best out of your people is to where everyone in your organization is not expected to lead a team. Fills you heard come courtesy of Mike Koenig. Thanks, Mike. Few things are as comforting as a powerful rotor shop. Speaking of which, if you like Warrior Poet, you might love our sister series, 100% Indivisible, the podcast about America. Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Shree.
No, Kevin. Mina do it. Spita.